You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 24th of November 2021 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily is brought to you in association with Allianz.
Sweden welcomes and farewells its first female prime minister. Ethiopia prepares for full-scale war. And who framed Istanbul's bus-riding dog? I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily in association with Allianz starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests Mari Lecomte and Kapil Komaredi will discuss all the day's big stories. Plus, we'll ask William Atkins what it was like to edit Granter's latest travel writing anthology at a time when nobody could go anywhere. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily in association with Allianz on Monocle 24. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I'm joined today by Mari Lecomte, political journalist and author, most recently of Honourable Misfits, a compendium of some of Britain's odder politicians, and by Kapil Komaredi, writer and author of Malevolent Republic, a short history of the new India. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Oh, hi.
Mari, because it's about to become a theme of our opening item, is there anywhere in your book a notably short-serving MP?
Oh, absolutely. There was one whose name I sadly can't remember, who got elected to Parliament and then went into his first debate in the chamber of the House of Commons, sat down, listened for half an hour and then thought, oh, actually, turns out not for me. And then never stepped foot in the House of Commons again.
I think you've done him kind of an appropriate service there by forgetting his name. I think it's what he would have wanted. Kapil, do you have any particular favourite short-serving governments? There is something quite compelling about somebody ascending to the pinnacle of power and then stepping or falling off it very shortly subsequently.
Yes, there was a government in the 90s, late 90s, the first Hindu nationalist government in India that lasted 14 days. And then India had a series of coalition governments from the centre to the left, and then the Hindu nationalists staged a comeback. But that was the shortest government in India's history. And obviously, Kamala Harris was a president for 1 hour.
That is true. She technically held the powers of the presidency for 1 hour. But 14 days, nevertheless, Kapil, the Swedes would reply with whatever the Swedish word is for amateurs. Because we will start in Sweden, which is generally proverbial as a bastion of political stability, but which may be on today's third prime minister as we go to air. Earlier, Sweden's parliament approved as PM Magdalena Andersson of the Social Democrats, previously finance minister, and the country began congratulating itself on becoming the last Nordic country to elect its first female national leader. However, a matter of maybe 8 hours later, she'd resigned, having failed to secure the votes to pass a budget. She had come and gone, indeed, before Wikipedia's list of Swedish prime ministers had been updated. I'm joined with more on this by Elizabeth Braw, resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and Swede. Elizabeth, basically what happened?
What happened was that the Prime Minister, Stefan Löfven, who has served for many years now, resigned because he wanted to pave the way for this crown princess within his party, Magdalena Andersson, to allow her to govern for about a year until the elections next year. And with that experience as prime minister, she would presumably be able to win a victory in her own right and go on to great glory. But what happened was that she did duly win the leadership race in her party. It was very easy because she was the anointed leader. And then she obviously had to put together a government, or rather ask the existing government to continue giving her support. And she went to Parliament for a vote, and she won that vote. But then people thought otherwise, and the Green Party, which governs in a coalition with the Social Democrats, resigned from the government. And on top of that, the opposition managed to get its version of a budget passed. So she would have had to govern without a coalition partner and with a budget passed by the opposition. And at that point, after those few hours, she decided to throw in the towel.
Did anybody see this outcome coming? Was this some kind of ambush staged by the opposition and or the Greens?
Well, it was an ambush. The Greens and the opposition are daggers drawn, but the fundamental problem is that even the existing government we had with Prime Minister Löfven and his Social Democrats and the Greens, even that government was extremely weak. It relies on the support of the Left Party on one hand and the Centre Party on the other hand. And the Left Party is the traditional sort of socialist party, and the Centre Party is very much a party of cosmopolitan neoliberals. So it's a very uneasy alliance, and these two supporting parties can at any given time threaten to withdraw support for the government, at which point the government falls. And that's what happened earlier this year when the Left Party withdrew support and Stefan Löfven had to resign. He then managed to regain their support and took power again. But that's how shaky things are, and it's not going to get any easier.
Well, just finally on that thought, and though with all due acknowledgement that the correct answer may just be an outburst of demented cackling, what does actually happen now?
Demented cackling. So what happens now is that Magdalena Andersson will try again to assemble a government with the Greens. That's what should happen. But what she has said she will do is that she will ask for support for a one-party government of Social Democrats only. Now, that would be a very weak government because the Social Democrats got less than 30% of the votes in the election. So it would be very much a minority government that would rely on the support of parties outside government in parliament. So, but that's what she intends to do. And I don't think the opposition parties would consider that any worse than the coalition has existed until now with the Greens. The Greens are a very small party, and they haven't exactly distinguished themselves in government or acquitted themselves very well at all. So I think the opposition might just decide to support Magdalena Andersson's bid to become the leader of the very much a minority government. But watch this space. I think we'll all be watching Twitter over the next few minutes and hours to see how long she lasts next time.
Elizabeth Brough, thank you for joining us. Now, Sweden is not the only European country today adapting to the idea of a new national leader. And at the risk of tempting fate, Germany's seems pretty likely to last. Olaf Scholz, leader of the Social Democrats, has sealed the coalition deal which will make him Angela Merkel's successor as Chancellor. Monocle's news editor Chris Chermak was listening to the press conference announcing Germany's new coalition just a few hours ago.
Meine verehrten Damen und Herren, bevor ich zum Anlass der heutigen Pressekonferenz komme, möchte ich mich zu einem sehr, sehr aktuellen Thema äußern. Corona ist nach wie vor nicht besiegt, leider.
It is a notable sign of the times, and perhaps of the man, that Olaf Scholz began his afternoon press conference announcing a new German coalition government, not by talking about that coalition at all. Instead, he announced a rash of new measures and steering committees with state leaders to confront the coronavirus pandemic and get Germans vaccinated. The implicit message? Despite Angela Merkel's departure, Germany remains in stable hands and will manage this latest crisis. Then it was down to business.
Die Ampel steht. SPD, Grüne und FDP haben sich in den Verhandlungen auf einen gemeinsamen Koalitionsvertrag verständigt und damit auf ein neues Regierungsbündnis. Diesen Vertrag legen wir nun unseren Parteien zur Abstimmung vor.
Germany has a new three-way coalition government between the Social Democrats, the Greens, and the Free Democrats. It's a so-called traffic light coalition based on the party colors. Red for the Social Democrats, yellow for the Free Democrats, and green for the Greens. Such a coalition of ideologically very different parties is unprecedented at the federal level in Germany. But then Olaf Scholz, in a rather dry attempt at humor that would make incumbent Angela Merkel proud, noted that the actual traffic light faced similar skepticism when it was first introduced on Potsdamer Platz in Berlin in 1924. Scholz, who will become chancellor, said this was not a coalition deal of the common denominator, but one of big plans. The coalition deal is indeed ambitious and bears the hallmarks of each of its three participants. Meeting the nation's climate goals will be made a priority of all government ministries, and implemented by a new climate and economy super ministry to be led by Robert Habeck of the Greens. The new government aims to exit coal power by 2030, 8 years earlier than planned before. Renewable energy will be scaled up to 80% of all electricity supply by 2030. And though the climate was clearly a priority of the Greens, it was notable that even Christian Lindner, leader of the pro-business Free Democrats, hailed the coalition pact for ushering in the most ambitious climate program of any industrial nation. For Christian Lindner's Free Democrats, there's the hallmark of fiscal responsibility. Lindner himself will lead the nation's finance ministry. Key for him and the Free Democrats is that this government will not raise taxes. It also promises to maintain a debt brake that, in Lindner's words, will keep Germany's reputation as a steward of fiscal responsibility intact, although the three parties have been rather tight-lipped on how exactly they plan to implement a raft of new spending plans without raising new debt or taxes. What's also less clear is exactly how or whether the new government will change Germany's foreign policy. Annalena Baerbock, co-leader of the Greens and the presumptive new foreign minister, promised a government that would fight for values and human rights across Europe and further abroad. Olaf Scholz said that Germany would continue to be a leader among democratic nations and maintain close relations with the United States. Christian Lindner promised a close partnership with the Western Military Alliance of NATO. Exactly what all of this means remains to be seen. It's fair to say that the coalition deal was far more focused on domestic policy than it was on Germany's place in the world. Still, what's notable in such times of political discord around the world is that this coalition came together at all. The leaders of all three parties conducted their negotiations over the past few weeks behind closed doors. They held a constructive working relationship that included lots of compromise and give and take. Christian Lindner hailed this as a government of the center. Over the next 10 days, it will be up to the parties to sign off on this coalition deal, and, with any luck, Olaf Scholz will be anointed chancellor on the 8th of December. Then, just like that, after 16 years, the Merkel era in Germany will be over. And the era of Scholz and his traffic light partners will have begun.
It's Monocle's news editor and indeed producer of this programme, Chris Chermak. Mario, I was tickled there, touched indeed, by Olaf Scholz's little traffic light joke. I would not myself have opened with it, and yet he did.
I thought it was quite endearing, actually, because, again, it is exactly the sort of, you know, could not be more sort of like careful kind of joke that I think politicians do. It's quite like, no one else would.
Kapil, it is an extraordinarily ideologically diverse coalition. It probably will hold together because German coalitions usually kind of do, but will it actually work?
You know, that traffic light anecdote that Scholz opened with is very interesting because Germans are very disciplined people. They observe and obey the rules. They don't cross the road when the light's red. But I fear that this traffic light coalition might not take off quite as well.
I was hoping you were going to pursue the metaphor still further somehow.
It's an ideologically kaleidoscopic coalition, and there are many, many differences between the three parties, beginning with vaccine passports and lockdowns. The Free Democrats do not believe on principle that there should be lockdowns or that people should be mandated to take vaccines. Mm. So that is going to become an issue as COVID cases surge. Number two is the phasing out of coal. They appear to have agreed on it in principle, but once the cost is factored into it, and they want to, on the one hand, maintain fiscal discipline, on the other hand, they will have to factor in the cost of phasing out coal. And then the international problems about standing up for human rights, and obviously, to what extent do they embrace America? To what extent do they alienate China? Chancellor Merkel was very good at playing this, but it's unclear whether Scholz will have the same gravitas on the international stage to pull it off.
I completely agree. And I think just to add as well, I wonder how much, like, to what extent Germany is about to kind of fall into the culture wars? Because I think some of the policies not mentioned earlier are things. So, you know, there's lots of very socially liberal policies in the coalition agreements, so from cannabis legalisation to finally allowing dual citizenship and making it easier for migrants to become German citizens, getting the voting age lowered to 16, strengthen reproductive rights, LGBT rights, etc. Like, there is so much on that. And I mean, being able to do all of that in, you know, presumably one term after quite a long time of, you know, someone who was fundamentally quite a socially conservative politician is, I think, going to be quite interesting.
Kappel, we should do a brief compare and contrast of the Germany's sort of solemn, stolid procession to coalition finally concluded today versus the shenanigans in Sweden. It's possible to take a positive view of all of it, isn't it? Isn't this is how parliamentary democracy is supposed to work? Sometimes it's a bit chaotic, even farcical, but nonetheless, that's all part of the deal.
That is part of the deal, but a country such as Germany perhaps cannot afford the farce that we've just seen in Sweden. Sweden can get away with it, but you remember the coalition government in Britain.
I try not to, but yes.
So, you know, you require the sort of, you require somebody to compromise. And I think at that time, Nick Clegg was willing to be the shield to David Cameron. His ministers were willing to bear the rage of the public, absorb that, and David Cameron was able to get away with it. But in Germany, it's, even though it's part of the democratic politics, Germans aren't very accustomed to this sort of government. And the compromises necessary to make it happen might the internal wrangling might spill into the public sphere, and I think that would endanger and imperil the coalition.
That might explain, just finally on this, Mari, the extraordinary heft of the coalition agreement.
Oh, yes. So my favourite fact that I learned today is that the coalition agreement is slightly longer than The Great Gatsby, just 51,000 words.
A choice of reading material there, then. Let's look now at Ethiopia, where Prime Minister and bewilderingly recent Nobel Peace Laureate Abiy Ahmed has reportedly made good on a previous promise to lead his army from the front as a climactic confrontation looms with militias from the country's north. Before departing for an as yet unconfirmed battlefield, he roused his people on Twitter as follows: "Those who want to be among the Ethiopian children who will be hailed by history, rise up for your country today." This is doubtless not how Ahmed saw things panning out when he sent federal troops to administer a brisk slapping down to the restive province of Tigray roughly this time last year. Kapil, this looks, it looks bad. It is bad. It could potentially get exponentially, in fact, scarcely unimaginably worse. Do you get the sense at this point, though, that Abiy Ahmed is actually serious, that is, when he talks about also the final stages of saving Ethiopia? Or is this an amount of desperate grandstanding, stake-raising, bluffing, if you will, hoping that the other mob will capitulate?
I think he increasingly reminds me of another tragic figure from history, Tsar Nicholas II, who went to the front lines as Russian Revolution broke out. I think President Ahmed is clearly trying to mobilise ordinary Ethiopians into picking up arms and fighting for his idea of a country. And it's very easy to dismiss Ahmed as a deranged lunatic, but I think what he's fighting for really is an idea of Ethiopia, of a united nation that transcends ethnic identities. And that is so commendable in theory, but in practice, the manner in which Ethiopian troops behaved in Tigray and lost the media war, his reputation really is tattered in the region, across the globe. His erstwhile allies are abandoning him. So President Ahmed wants to demonstrate that he is willing to risk his own life for Ethiopia's unity. Because if Tigrayans march into Addis, the Ethiopian state will fragment. There is a very serious risk that Ethiopia will balkanize. And the vision he wants to instill in his people, impart and fight for and defend is really, in theory, again, a very commendable vision. You know, it's if you were to translate what is happening in Ethiopia here, you know, that would be like saying, "I'm white, I will have my own nation. You're brown, you will have your own nation." That's a reprehensible, objectionable idea when it happens here. And we should be able to say that it's bad when it happens in Africa as well. But I think Ahmed has just ceased to be the figure to make that argument, because his credibility is in tatters, sadly.
Murray, Kapil uses the ominous word balkanize there, and the nightmare scenario here is 115 million people reenacting the fall of Yugoslavia in the Horn of Africa. Now, when that happened in Yugoslavia, Europe and the wider West did all they could not to have anything to do with it, despite the fact that it was literally, well, not even happening next door to Europe, happening in Europe. If Ethiopia does properly implode, nobody is going to want to touch this with a barge pole, are they?
No, I don't believe so. And it's also, I think, especially striking because Ahmed was a leader quite early on who everyone wanted to see and spend time with. So like Emmanuel Macron even went to Addis, I believe, in 2019 and, you know, kind of had all these meetings. And what I think is more on Ahmed's advisor's side, but they tried very hard to say, you know, actually, they're quite alike. You know, they were born 16 months apart and they love tech and then you're thrusting young leaders and so on. That's obviously completely stopped. So I don't really see what country... could do anything at this stage. And in slight fairness to them as well, I'm not entirely sure any of them could actually help, even if they wanted to right now.
Kapil, if the TPLF, or the Tigray Defence Forces, as they're now trading, do take Addis Ababa, and they have done it before, of course, in 1991, when they rousted the Derg and then ran Ethiopia for decades, is that what would happen again? Would they be able to hold, I mean, I know this is extraordinarily speculative at this point, but would they be potentially able to hold Ethiopia together?
Well, what's important to remember this time is that the coalition forged by TPLF is in opposition to Abiy Ahmed. If he is removed from the picture, he supplies the cohesion to the coalition. And if he's removed, the coalition will develop new rifts, and that will result in a sort of fragmentation within the coalition, which will then be reflected, I fear, across the country. So holding Ethiopia together will require serious international intervention that actually begins by telling everyone to pull back. It is not impossible to conceive of a situation where the world actually gets involved. But as you mentioned, they didn't do it in Yugoslavia. So why the hell would they do it in Africa?
Indeed.
Otherwise, this country is really this is one of the great success stories of Africa, notwithstanding all the cruelties that the people have endured. And if this country falls apart, you're looking what looks today like a crisis will look in years to come like a calamity.
Just a final thought on this one, Murray, and it's not specific to Ethiopia, but just a general observation about politics, about which you have written in many guises and environments. It strikes me that here there is quite a common dynamic, and it's a conundrum that I don't think anybody's really come up with an answer to. It's that thing where so many things in politics are so very much easier to get into than get out of. You get into something, in this case, what was supposed to be a fairly brisk punitive expedition to a somewhat restive province. A year later, you are on the verge of destroying your own country, and it doesn't seem to be possible for anybody to say, what are we doing?
It feels a bit dark to be witty about a topic that dark. But you know, maybe everyone could learn, actually, from the recent former Swedish Prime Minister. Sometimes you just have to leave it about 8 hours in.
Murray LeConte and Kapil Komaredi, thank you both for the moment. You are listening to The Daily. We'll have more from our panel right after this.
For more than 130 years, Allianz has expanded its business and stretched its brand in new and innovative ways. And while the world looks very different today than it did back in 1890, one truth remains. Allianz's passion for securing people's lives and giving them courage for what's ahead, no matter what. The world is a better place when people have more courage than fear. Especially in uncertain times, people seek stability and confidence. Today, we're putting the future of mobility firmly in the spotlight. With waves of innovation, a rapid evolution in tech and industry, and a new era of service upon us, it's an area ripe with both challenge and potential opportunity. Thomas Kunzman, CEO Mobility and Assistance at Allianz Partners, is here to talk about the meaning and future of mobility. Thomas, welcome. What does freedom of mobility, what does that mean to you, Thomas?
Freedom is far more than just to get from A to B. It really means to have freedom, have the ability to get somewhere where I would like to get, and not just the pure A to B way. It's been in the age of 7 when my mom took a car in that time and left the Czech Republic, flew through the wall of the German barrier that has been in 1989 through Europe. So for me, mobility, cars, and having the opportunity to really get to a different world in really the sense is something very, very close to my heart. If I look on my business perspective, clearly mobility is something that has been reinvented during the last years. And it is a great and exciting development I see in how customer-focused finally this area and this industry is getting, and moving from a very siloed manufacturing perspective into a customer-oriented service.
Thomas Kunzmann, CEO Mobility and Assistance at Allianz Partners, talking about the future of mobility. More ways in which you can unlock, build and maintain confidence today and tomorrow with Allianz. Allianz, behind you for what's ahead.
Welcome back to the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller. Still with me are our guests Marie Leconte and Kapil Komaredi. Now, the conclusion of a friendship pact between France and Italy is not probably the stuff of which Nobel Peace Prizes are made. Give or take an amount of the sort of squabbles common among neighbours, the two haven't really gotten into it properly since Louis Napoleon sent an expeditionary force to clobber the Roman Republic and restore Pope Pius IX in 1849. Nevertheless, both will attempt to conjure celebratory ballyhoo tomorrow when President Emmanuel Macron, much like Lieutenant General Charles Oudinot before him, travels to Rome. He and Italian Prime Minister Mario Draghi will sign the somewhat unromantically named French-Italian Enhanced Cooperation Treaty. Mari, as the representative of the Republic of France at this table, how excited are you about this?
Oh, I mean, you know, I'll be drinking tonight until, you know, the early hours to celebrate.
I know, we should make it clear to viewers that you are wearing your half and half France-Italy scarf and...
No, I am, yeah. I've got the onions and the balls of mozzarella as well. So, yeah, no, it's really, you know, really dressed up for the occasion. No, it's not. I mean, let's be honest. You know, it's not the most exciting thing. It is quite interesting because I think that France-Italy relationships had been quite tense over the past few years. Obviously, we famously recalled our ambassador to Italy, I think, in 2019 over Salvini, I think, calling on Macron to resign, or 2017, I can't remember when that was.
That was not tactful.
It was not. Éric Zemmour, the presidential hopeful, over the summer called, I think, on France to retake northern Italy, or take it in general, saying it's basically more French than Italian, on national French telly. So again, you know, it's not been, in the grand scheme of things, we've been okay, but actually, you know, it's not been the best of relationships recently. So maybe, you know, a step in the right direction.
Kapil, is there an amount of positioning going on here for both France and Italy? You know, that we are now approaching both a post Brexit and post-Merkel Europe. Is this? I mean, if we're trying to sort of conjure the game of diplomacy metaphor here, who are France and Italy ganging up on?
No, they're quite. I think Germany was the stabilising factor in this. And now that Germany itself is in some sort of a political, I won't call it crisis, but difficulty, and it's just staging a comeback, I think Italy and France coming together and forging this union after a series of misunderstandings that Marine pointed out, I think, is going to supply an element of stability to the European Union. Remember that Macron has been president for 4 years, and in that time he's seen off 3 Italian leaders. Right. This is the third. And
so you had a period of remarkable stability for post-war Italy.
And he's I was just in over the past few weeks in both in Italy and France. The contrast is remarkable. In Italy, there is a fixation with France. In France, there is a fixation with France. and you know, the French do not really are not that keen on, you know, that they are in their own world. And Zemmour was cited a second ago. He said that, he blurted that out almost you know, with contempt, as though as a joke against the Italians. And the Italians took that with great seriousness. They were greatly affronted. But this coalition, this treaty, is certainly going to consolidate a friendship that is good for Europe while Germany actually recovers from the trauma of Merkel's exit.
Just a final quick one on this, Mari. You were quite right that there was a certain amount of Freudeur, and whatever the Italian word for Freudeur is, at that period when Five Star were in government in Italy. And that was when you had Matteo Salvini calling for Macron to resign and Five Star cozying up ostentatiously to the Gilets Jaunes, etc. And you can kind of see that Macron and Mario Draghi are fairly obvious, sensible, centrist, kindred spirits. And I guess that's why this treaty makes sense now. But could it all go askew if presidential elections on both sides of the Alps next year go, well, let's say, askew?
Very possibly. I mean, I still think, at least on the French side, it's not hugely likely that it goes very askew. But in any case, what's actually quite interesting, I think, about this treaty is that we're yet to have that, you know, much detail really about it. I tried to read into it and say, you know, what is that going to entail? There's not much yet, and I think it's going to be worked out over the next sort of like weeks and months. So there may be just some fudging, I suspect, you know, until the next presidents, whoever they are elected.
Well, to Turkey now, where a stray dog is at the centre of a to-do verging on an outright brouhaha. Here to explain further is Monocle's Lillian Fawcett.
Who let the dogs out?
Boji the street dog has become a local celebrity in the Turkish city of Istanbul. He's been using the city's public transport system completely alone for months now, riding metros, ferries and buses. City officials say he travels up to 30 kilometres every day. Boji even has dedicated Instagram and Twitter accounts, with tens of thousands of followers for each. But not everyone in Istanbul is charmed by Boji's street smarts. Last week, a local news report accused him of pooing on a tram. They tweeted what seemed to be an incriminating photo. Then, in a bizarre twist, a spokesman for Istanbul's municipal authority released CCTV footage which appeared to show a man planting the poo on a tram seat, possibly to frame poor Boji. Boji too insisted he was elsewhere at the time of the incident, in a public response from his own Twitter account. Many Istanbulites think President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's AKP party is to blame. The first images of the poop in question do seem to have come from a pro-AKP news account on Twitter. But why bother framing a floppy-eared street dog? Erdogan's AKP party lost control of the city in 2019 elections, and Istanbul's mayor is now a key opposition figure. Slandering the unofficial city mascot Boji and making the city look poorly run could undermine city authorities, or so the theory goes. How high up the chain does the political conspiracy go? Well, one thing's for sure, Boji's celebrity status is here to stay.
Lillian Fawcett, thank you. Kapil, we do need to get to grips, I think, with the conspiracy theory here. Does it seem to you more likely that Boji is being framed by an undercover AKP operative or just some weirdo? I guess we do have to consider the possibility that undercover AKP operative and some weirdo are not necessarily mutually exclusive descriptions.
You're excluding the possibility that Boji is maybe trying to stage a run for the presidency. And this is all part of his big plan.
You think it's a false flag operation?
It's probably a false flag operation run by one of his many staff. Look, the AKP people, as you just put, are very weird people. They are suddenly worried. I really don't know if this, you know, framing this dog is part of their plan. But some of them actually really bizarrely hate dogs and dislike dogs. There is a strain of that. I've been to Turkey. I've met the AKP people. They dislike dogs.
How does that come up in conversation? You're just chatting to the AKP about politics and they say, you know what I don't like? Dogs.
That came up because we were talking about pets, and they said, you know, we are not supposed to keep dogs. That's not part of the religion, and they're not supposed to keep dogs. So that's come up. And I think Boji might have... I really don't know what's behind this. I can't claim to know. I'll have to look deeper into this. But I think the ability in today's Turkey to prevail against AKP, a coordinated campaign to slander, and he still comes out at the top, I think that bespeaks the popularity of this wonderful creature.
Well, yeah, I would declare myself at this point as unabashedly pro-Boji. He seems a damn handsome hound.
I vote for him.
Yeah, I am vexed that I did not get to meet him personally on my most recent visit to Istanbul a few years ago, and I did spend quite a lot of time on buses, trams and ferries. A lot of stray cats in Istanbul. That is a big thing in Istanbul. Stray cats by the hundred. Shops leave out food and water for them. The fishermen down catching fish in the Bosporus throw them their spares. But Murray, do you have any particular favourite street animals beyond Boji?
I am very glad you asked, because yes, I do. I think protest dogs have long been one of my sort of like pet passions. So one of the main ones was Negro Matapacos in Chile. So I think he originally started basically barking at the police during the student protest of 2011 and became such a symbol that actually during the protest last year against police brutality, he became the icon basically of this protest. Then in Greece as well, during the big anti-austerity movement and riots and stuff, there was Loukounikos, which means sausage. He was a dog who similarly would basically attack the police officers who would try to attack the protesters, and who became this great symbol. So he died sadly a few years ago. I believe there are now memorials and statues of him in Greece. So yeah, I would say to Erdogan, you know, be careful what you wish for, because quite often I think these dogs do end up becoming symbols of great movements.
Well, that, as a concluding note, does cue up a nice prompt for the current edition of The Foreign Desk, which you can listen to straight after this, because I am reminded that on my first visit to Kosovo in 2004, I think, I met a young activist who was leading a donkey down Nena Teresa Boulevard in Pristina, draped in a banner which had "Vote for Me" written on the side of it, as a protest against the then UN-sponsored elections. His name was, and indeed is, Albin Kurti. He's now the Prime Minister, and you can hear that interview from our website or wherever fine podcasts are downloaded. But Kapil Komaredi and Mari Leconte, thank you both for joining us. And finally, on today's show, The Last Little While will not, for obvious reasons, be recalled as a golden era of travel writing. Nevertheless, Granta has issued its regular compendium of travel writing, this time entitled Should We Have Stayed at Home? Like it might be retorted, we had much choice. Earlier, I spoke to the book's editor, the travel writer William Atkins. I began by asking him what it was like to edit a travel magazine during a pandemic.
I was asked to edit this volume towards the end of 2019, so before the world went entirely mad. And I think when the news, when it became apparent that really travel was not going to be possible, at least in the way it had been prior to, you know, March 2020, my first feeling was, well, this is scuppered. You know, we can't commission an anthology or a collection of travel writing commissions if nobody can actually travel. But actually, I, with Granta, monitored what was happening, and we made the decision really that this could go ahead. And so what that meant was that some of the pieces that had been commissioned had to be revisited, had to be replanned. There's a piece by Sinead Gleeson, wonderful Irish writer, for example. She was originally planning to go to Lourdes, and in the event ended up writing about a journey she'd made to Brazil, which touched on many of the same themes as it happened, but a journey she had made in 2019. And there were other similar kind of commissions that were kind of shifted because of the reality of the times. But what I think happened, actually, somewhat to my surprise, is that this period of stasis we all experienced, it forced us to think about travel more deeply, in a more mindful way. And I think that's reflected in the contents of this collection.
Well, it's also reflected in the title, Should We Have Stayed at Home? One might retort, like we had a choice. But I think that's true. I think a lot of people who did travel for a living, whether they were travel writers or any other sort of travellers, did end up thinking about why they did it and whether there was any real reason for them to do it as much or in the same way. And a lot of it's summed up, I think, in a terrific piece by Eliane Brom about two extraordinarily hostile yet important environments, that one that she lives in, the Amazon, and one that she visits, the Antarctic. And she does ask the question, and she's talking about it, I think, in terms of, it's a question she's asking about a lot of the way we live, but it's obviously asked about travel. Just because we can, should we?
It's a really central line in the whole collection, I'd say. And I think she's asking that partly because, you know, she's thinking about carbon footprint, of course. But I also think that Eliane in that remarkable piece is thinking about her presence in these places that are not really owned, if you like, by human beings, her home, the Amazon, and the place she visits, the Antarctic. And she feels like something of a trespasser in this non-human world of the Antarctic. I also think she's thinking about the kind of legacy of colonialism, particularly as it relates to the Amazon. So I think all of these pieces, and particularly Eliane's, are thinking about the kind of obligations of travellers, the responsibilities of travellers, what it means to travel, why we travel, and what it means for those we travel among as well.
Do you think there is a kind of, I think existential crisis might be too strong a term, but certainly a kind of sense of reflection descending upon travel writing? Because I get it myself as somebody who has, you know, dabbled in various sorts of travel writing in, at various points. I think it was much more obvious what the purpose of it was back before everybody was plugged into everything all the time. Whereas now I think it's very easy once you get to a place to find yourself thinking, do I really need to be here? There is nothing I can find out really by being here myself that any Yahoo with a laptop anywhere in the world can't find out probably actually more quickly and probably more reliably.
I think there are exceptions to what I'm about to say, but my feeling is that the age of exploration is over. That's not to say that individual discovery is not possible. Travel writing is notoriously challenging genre, if we call it a genre, to define. And that's one of its charms, of course, that we can't quite pin down exactly what we mean when we talk about travel writing. But at least for the purposes of this collection of writing I put together, I thought about it in terms of, well, one mind's account of an experience with an unfamiliar place, as simple as that. So it was about what happens to us when we go to a place that is not our home, when we're torn from those things that are familiar, from our loved ones, from a culture, a place, an environment we're familiar with. How does that affect our mind? How do we interpret that place accordingly? And in that, there is still the opportunity for the most profound discovery, I think.
There is a recurring theme, though, and it's something you were getting at with what you were saying about Eliane Brum's piece about the impact of colonialism, that a lot of these pieces do find themselves appear concerned with the effect that the traveller has on the destination. And obviously that can be very small or it can be very, very big. I was obviously inevitably struck as an Australian by James Tyler's photo essays, where he demonstrates the impact of colonisation of the Australian continent with black and white pictures of landscapes on which there's just a big black square occluding what has been built in modern times.
Yes, James Tyler's photo essay is extraordinary, and the visual is quite an important element of this this issue of Granta. I think what I would say is that travellers historically have not been travelling in leisure. And so on the one hand, we have the colonial traveller you've just alluded to, the explorer, the adventurer, the soldier. And then on the other hand, you have a party that is a really big part of this collection, and that's the unwilling traveller, the migrant, the refugee. And I suppose one of the things that is happening, I think, to travel writing is a heightened awareness of what it means to travel in a kind of coerced way, let's say, or in a way where your interest is something other than simply leisure or discovery or indeed travel writing. And I think that's one of the things that enriches this collection, is an engagement on the writer's part with those travellers who are either there for extractive reasons, i.e. you know, colonialism, or they're travelling unwillingly because they're fleeing something.
Did you get the sense, putting this collection together, either from the works themselves or from the conversations you had with the contributors and other travel writers, that not just travel writing, perhaps, but that travel might be fundamentally different out the other side of the pandemic? I mean, it is an extraordinary moment in human history when you think about it, that there was this quite prolonged period where most travel, certainly most leisure travel, just kind of stopped. Is it your anticipation that it will go back to something what it was like when you started working on this book in 2019, or is everything now different?
Well, it's just been this unprecedented period, hasn't it? To state the obvious. And I think it's very hard to anticipate how the next few years, let alone the next few decades, are going to evolve in every way. And that includes how we continue to approach travel, whether it's as tourists or as travel writers or in any other form. I suspect that there will be a bid to return to the old normal as soon as it's practically possible. But I think also people really have, and I mean the public generally, have begun to think more deeply about their home patch. There's something I quote in the introduction to this issue of Granta by the American poet Gary Snyder. And he says, the most radical thing you can do is stay at home. So his idea of staying at home is a form of activism, if you like. But I also think we've all begun to, or perhaps those of us who are lucky enough to be able to go walking around the block or in our local park, for example, to value what's on our doorstep and to look more deeply at what's on our doorstep and think about the possibilities of discovery in the local, if you like. So perhaps that will be a kind of lasting legacy, an awareness of the value of our kind of immediate home environment.
That was William Atkins, editor of the latest iteration of Granta's travel magazine, this year entitled Should We Have Stayed at Home? And that's all for this edition of The Daily. A big thanks to our panellists today, Marie Leconte and Kapil Komaredi, also to Elizabeth Braw at the top of the show. Today's show was produced by Chris Chermack and researched by Sophie Monaghan-Coombs and Lillian Fawcett. Our sound engineer was Louis Allen. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily returns at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.